This is the IBJ podcast for the week of April the 22nd, 2024, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome to the 300th episode, everybody. The IBJ podcast debuted on June the 3rd, 2018, and has returned nearly every week since then. For those of you who have hung around since the early days, I can't tell you how grateful I am. And I hope you're still finding these weekly conversations useful, illuminating, and even surprising. If you're just joining us, thanks for devoting some time to checking out the podcast. In what has been something of a tradition for podcast anniversaries, we're checking in this week with Pete Dunn, aka Pete the Planner, to get his latest take on personal finance and some of the knottier issues that arise when managing your money. One of the most common questions we hear, and indeed the most common question I ask myself, is, will I have enough money for retirement? If you've taken anything away from Pete's appearances over the last 6 years, I hope you've secured two ideas. One, the answer can vary widely depending on the retiree in question. And two, you should also be asking, how can I reduce the amount of money I will need in retirement? In this episode, Pete explores, for the first time, the relationship between career earnings and the assets you've accumulated. It's a different way to think about what you've saved so far, as well as how much more you need to put away before you retire. Along those lines, we also spend a significant amount of time talking about the role that your housing decisions play in retirement readiness. And if you listen closely, you'll also hear a recommendation for a book of financial advice that, despite being nearly 100 years old, is still valuable today. Here's our conversation. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the podcast, Pete Dunn, aka Pete the Planner. Thank you for joining me on what is the 300th episode of the IBJ podcast.
For the people out there that I annoy, unfortunately, it's got to feel like I've been on 600 times. And for the small population that do enjoy when I'm on, primarily my mother, she's very excited that I'm here.
My mom also likes you. So you
really?
Oh, yeah.
That's nice. Thanks for saying that.
You know, I'm a little concerned because I always associate 300th episodes with the Simpsons 300th episode, which was a colossal disappointment.
Yeah. Well, here we go.
So let's go.
Let's do it.
Let's see how it works. And we're going to introduce a new topic, at least for me today, something we have not talked about before. Clean slate, lifetime earnings.
Yeah.
And I really am going into this blind. Tell me what we're talking about today.
This is trust, friends. This is trust. Mason's like, what you got? And I said, you know what? I've been wanting to explore something. I haven't written about it, but I think about it a lot. And here's the idea. So it's sort of sports league draft season, right? You've got the WNBA draft. Caitlin Clark, the new mayor of Indianapolis, with all due respect to Mayor Hogsett. We've got the NFL draft on the horizon. And so you start thinking about these contracts that these folks sign. And then the conversation heads to, well, what's their lifetime earnings? You know, the Masters just went on. So you see these golfers and what their lifetime earnings are. And we all look from afar and we're like, well, that's neat. You know, what's their net worth now? But how often do we turn that lens introspective and say, okay, what have been your lifetime earnings? What, like, if you sit back, you grab your tax record, which is always a fun thing to find, and you say, what have I earned in my adult career? And then this is where the rubber hits the road, my friend. What do I have to show for it? And I find this to be a very fascinating exercise.
I used to get a mailer from the Social Security Administration that would say, here's what your income was every single year. And I guess that's moved online now. And because I'm illiterate online, I don't know how to find it. But is that a good place to start?
Yeah, ssa.gov. And the other way you can actually go and you can get your tax record at irs.gov. But ssa.gov would be the best way to get your earning history. And I am not here to suggest, Mason, that people shield their income from the Social Security Administration. But if you're listening to this now and you think, well, I've actually earned more than I've reported, or because of tax situations, I've earned more than my tax documents would suggest. You need to take that into account. But I'm with you. When that paper document, it was like that little 4-page deal. I love that thing. Mm-hmm. I love that thing. And it went away. So go figure.
Yeah, it was neat. I loved seeing how much I was earning as a dishwasher when I was 16 years old. Working two jobs in Broad Ripple.
It is fascinating. And I think here's why this fascinates me, this entire idea. When you're in the midst of earning a wage, especially early in your career, it's the most you've ever earned. In itself, it feels substantial. It feels significant. And then what happens over time is we get lulled into the wage feeling less significant. And so we put less pressure on ourselves to make good of that increasing wage. And what I think that leads to is we take the scrutiny off of ourselves. And when we aggregate that income and we say, okay, I have earned $2.4 million in my career. And again, random number I'm pulling out there. And then you say, and my net worth is $600,000. And it makes you say, what will my total earnings be? What can I predict them to be, project them, forecast them to be? And then what will I have to show for it? I think it's an interesting exercise in how resourceful are you and how good are you at investing your earnings? And I'd love to chat through this.
Yeah. Go ahead. So the first thing that I'm looking at is lifetime earnings up to this point.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just pick some random numbers. Let's say that you've been in the workforce for 10 years. On average, you've, by the way, you and I feel like this week I've been in the workforce for 10 years. Like this week alone, and it's only Thursday. Wait, no, it's Wednesday. This has been an entire decade.
I have less than 10 years left in my workable life.
By the way, you know what? And we can talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
You can quantify that. I mean, take your wage, multiply by 10, increase it by some level of COLA, and you've got how much money you're going to earn for the rest of your life. That'll wake you up.
I'm not taking anything for granted. I'm not going to throw the COLA in there.
You don't want to jinx yourself?
No.
So let's say you've been in the workforce 10 years and you've averaged, when it's all said and done, $70,000. You're going to want $700,000 of lifetime earnings at that point. Now, you and I have been in the workforce for at least 25 years apiece. Is that fair to say?
Oh, for sure.
Okay. So when you look back at your SSA.gov statement and you can just add up the wages, or if you just think it's like, well, I earn this now, I used to earn this, let me find a number in the middle, and you calculate it, what you grow to understand is how much of that capital went to lifestyle, how much of that capital went towards the future, and you have to be somewhat introspective and say, how much of that lifestyle went to solve a massive, weird problem that I never expected to happen. And I say that to extend some grace to some folks and hope that they'll do it to themselves, where maybe like cancer got in the way or divorce got in the way or these sorts of things that tend to decrease a person's net worth as opposed to increase in it.
Perfect example. So I bought a condo in Chicago for, I think, $145,000. In what would have been 2002. 6 years later, boom, Great Recession. I've got to get out of Chicago. I have to sell this unit. And I was lucky, I tell you, lucky to sell that unit for $110,000.
And so everyone is wondering right now, all of your listeners, millions of people are tripping over themselves to ask this question to you, but I'm in the position to ask it. Have you done a Zillow on that property recently?
Yes, I have, baby.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I did.
Okay. So 145 to 110. And by the way, here's what's fascinating about this. During that period of time, you earned wages, right? And those wages theoretically would have helped you live within the mortgage, purchase it. But those wages had a negative, theoretical negative impact. That's a bad period for you, you know? That's to my point. What's the property now?
You know, I'm lucky-ish. It was like a junior one bedroom. So it's not something that was going to accrue in value like a one or a two bedroom. I think the last time I saw it, I think it might've been 175.
Okay. That's not bad. You can still sleep at night.
Yeah, it's fine.
But let me give you a different example of that. So let's say, and I think probably since then, and you and I've talked real estate before on this, you've made other real estate decisions that are quite positive.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And so that's what's interesting, because this is so many legs. There's this idea that home ownership is unequivocally an amazing idea, right? That it is. I saw an email newsletter the other day that said why homeownership is the perfect way to build wealth, so much so that I'm actually talking about that on my radio show this week. And Mason, the fact is that's not true. That's just not true, because it depends on what situation you're willing to put yourself in. If you're going to get a 30-year mortgage of a home you can barely afford in a production neighborhood from a production builder, you're not going to build wealth. If you are patient and you make a more reasonable real estate decision, you will build wealth. So I think this idea of measuring your lifetime income and what you have to show for it, it holds water.
Yeah. You know, I mean, even the question of when you're measuring your net worth, I mean, you are including the value of your home, which is, I mean, to an extent, is speculative. I mean, there's what the tax people say is worth, you know, when they want to give you the tax bill, and then you can base it on what they call the comps, you know, the other homes in your neighborhood that have sold in the meantime, which in my neighborhood have been amazing. You know, our house isn't anywhere close to being the nicest house on the street, but boy, it blows my mind. I feel like, you know, I really shouldn't be paying this much in taxes.
I would note that even that sort of that asset and that equity is still worth measuring within this equation, right? Because ultimately where you're trying to go with this is, how much money do you need to be able to retire, which is one of the age-old questions everyone tries to answer. And if you look at that number in relation to your lifetime earnings, you can start to discern some pretty interesting things. You can say, okay, well, my home is an asset. I own it outright. It contributes to my net worth. And because of that decision, owning it outright, I actually need less retirement assets because I don't need as much income generated. Whereas if you're making poor housing decisions, it actually requires you to have higher level of retirement assets. And I think people conveniently forget that when they get into, oh, it's a home. You can't put a price on creating a family environment. It's like, well, no, there is math, and you do need to take it into account.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think as we've discussed on previous editions of the show, so we got a 15-year refi about, I don't know, 9 years ago.
Okay.
And so 6 years from now, you can take like $850 off of our monthly expenses. So it is worth, I mean, if nothing else, it is worth that much money because we have no housing costs.
I also think this calls into question the prudence of a 30-year mortgage if you're not aggressively investing the difference between a 30 and a 15. Because here's what I mean. If you look at any amortization table and it says, this is the cost of, this is the loan, this is the principal of the loan, but here's the total cost of borrowing over 15 or 30 years. It's that total amount that your income goes to pay. So when you pay a higher amount of interest, it is, again, to my example, proving that you can make bad real estate decisions even as it relates to the funding of the mortgage. I think this is an amazing conversation to have with your financial advisor, is to say, I'm going to only have so much money I'm going to earn my entire life. What are the best ways to maximize it? And if for some reason the advisor says, I will get a 30-year mortgage for as much home as you can buy and don't invest any on the side, then you can rest assured that that's a terrible mistake and your net worth will suffer for it.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft. today's modern law firm, with more than 800 attorneys in 8 primary Midwest markets and the District of Columbia, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IVJ Podcast in my discussion about career earnings and savings with Pete the Planner. Okay, so let's get back to lifetime earnings before I get lost. All right, let's say my lifetime earnings, I think you pulled out $2.4 million, right?
Sure.
Okay, we'll and then $600,000 I've established is my net worth, which conveniently is 25%.
Of my numbers.
Yeah, how about that? I'm the go-to person for math in the family. So what does that tell me, that 25%, that my net worth is 25% of my lifetime earnings? Is that good? Is that bad? Is that?
So this is where I don't have any hard and fast rules, but I'll give you directionally, like from a trajectory standpoint of where you want to go. The closer you get to retirement, the older you get, the more you've earned, the higher percentage of your lifetime earnings you want your net worth to be. I believe my wife as an English teacher will have just thrown up hearing the way I just said that with conjugation and everything. Anyway, I'll deal with that when I get home. You just want a higher percentage of your net worth represented from your lifetime earnings. When you're young, let's go to your first year. You earn $30,000. You got $3,000 to your name after starting a 401k or something like that. It's 10%.
Oh, yeah, if you're lucky, yeah.
It's 10%. Right. How much of that can you keep going forward? By the time you retire, in order to self-sustain yourself, that percentage has got to start to shrink or increase, I should say.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a 56-year-old guy. My percentage is 25%.
Okay.
What do I do with that information?
A couple things. Number one, if I'm you, as you look at, this is why, you know, we've talked on the show about my afternoon on December 31st, you know, where everyone else is putting on tuxedos and chilling champagne and I'm running my net worth on every December 31st. One of the things I'm actually tracking is how does my net worth look in comparison to my lifetime earnings? So that is something I track, and I want to see that number go up, because not only does it show that I'm having good habits in that year of making the right contributions, but it's also evaluating the investment decisions I make, because I want my investments to actually do the work. Go back to the basics of learning about investing. You think about the amazing book, The Richest Man in Babylon, which is required reading for anyone who wants to learn about investing when you're in your 20s or 30s. And the idea is that your money's working for you. I think under this scenario, at one point in time, the onus of having your net worth be a percentage of your lifetime earnings flips over to your assets themselves. They have to do the work. That's why a poor housing decision or a poor mortgage decision puts so much strain on this concept.
So I guess to a point where I shouldn't be concerned so much about the percentage. I'm just worried about the gross amount of assets that I have.
Well, the goal in this is, first off, to does it pass the sniff test? Let's go back to this $2.4 million. And let's say that all you've ever earned in your entire career, let's say a 45-year career, let's say I'm just math on the radio. Everyone loves that. 45-year career, you've earned $2.4 million. That means you've averaged $53,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
At $600,000 of net worth, off of that, that would suggest that you can generate somewhere between $18,000 to $24,000 a year of income. That's not good, because it's half of what your average career earnings were. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
But I'm stretching it off of 45 years as opposed to your, I don't know, we'll call it a 28-year career at this point.
I don't know.
let's focus on this, and not to make you sad, but let's focus on most of your listeners, most of the readership of the IBJ are people of a particular age, of a particular economic status. How about trying to project forward of what your earnings are going to be for the remainder of your career. I think that is a fascinating thing to say, how can you make the most of the finite amount of money that you're going to be exposed to for the remainder of your career? Does that idea, without jinxing yourself, right? Does this idea terrify you, or is that interesting to you?
I'm interested. Sure.
Do you feel...
I think about it.
Do you feel empowered to make better use of those dollars once you quantify them? Or do you feel like, well, I'll quantify them, but what's it really matter? My life's going to continue on in the same trajectory.
No, I want to make better use of them. Absolutely.
What I think this gets into is a couple different things. I think it gets into these the concept of making great major purchases, showing discretion around major purchases. When people start going, oh, I've always wanted to do this, I deserve this. You know, oh, we've always wanted a lake house, or we've always wanted to go here, or we've always wanted to pay for our kids' grad school. And you try to justify those decisions on a qualitative basis and on a values-driven basis. But at some point in time, if you're trying to compare those purchases to the impact it can have on your financial life and your lifetime earnings, they're shedding a different light, in my opinion.
My point of view for the next 10 years basically has been to put away as much money as I can.
Okay. Can we pick makeup numbers? No one wants to hear specifically. Actually, people probably do want to hear specifically about your financial life, but as your friend, I'm going to advise you not to put it out there.
Okay.
But just make it up. It doesn't matter. Just pick a 10 year number.
Let's say that I make $100,000 a year. So let's just make a big round number. So I would have
$1 million.
$1 million.
Okay. I love this conversation. Now people have stopped turning this off. They're excited. All right. $1 million. You will come in contact with another $1 million. How much of that do you think is reasonable to set aside during that time frame? Forget interest, but how much do you think you should be able to set aside of that?
I am pretty comfortable because I know that already for the 401k, I have the ability to put away more than maybe a younger person can. I think I am putting away 15%.
Okay.
Now, this all gets skewed by my wife.
Sure, sure.
Who is fairly significantly younger than I am. So she has her own savings that are going into the same pot. And probably lifetime has been much better than I about saving money for retirement.
Well, it's because of those lunches you have down on the circle. We've talked about this before.
Dude, you don't know.
I do know. I don't know you.
What I have had to go through. Oh my God. I'm on the Mediterranean diet right now because I have triglycerides that are so high that my doctor called me in for a special appointment and said, you are in deep trouble.
An intervention. Were there candles?
It was an intervention. And that what was great about that was that it finally got me to stop spending money on restaurants downtown because the food down here sucks. Okay.
Wow, man. I don't think that's making the pod.
No, I think it is. I mean, it is twice as expensive as it was 15 years ago. And it's mostly, you know, it's junk food. I mean, for the most part, if I want to eat really healthily, it's going to cost, I mean, multiples of what going to Chick-fil-A is going to cost. And so what I've had to do literally is get, I mean, just bucketfuls of vegetables and fish and bring them to work with me so I can eat.
I think your IBJ coworkers can stop emailing me about all the sardines you eat at your desk now is what you're suggesting.
You think that's funny. That is literally what I just did half an hour ago.
I know, dude, I'm telling you, I know you. Okay. So anyway, let's go back to this idea. Cause I think, and don't get caught up in your wife. Let's just say you're single. I mean, we're making up wages. Let's just make up that you're out there on the town.
Sure.
All right. So you have $1 million of earnings yet to come. You've just committed to $150,000 of that will be set aside and secured, right?
Into an investment that I expect to grow minimum 5% a year.
Okay. I'm not pulling out my financial calculator, but we'll still get there. How much on top of that are you committed to in this hypothetical of setting aside a year on top of what you're putting in your 401k?
Oh boy. If we're talking about Bachelor Mason, it would be nothing. That would be it.
That's a good point. You're out there doing a lot of spray tans, gold chains. I feel you.
Oh yeah, a lot of eating out, a lot of traveling, a lot of like crazy late night Amazon binging, you know.
Okay, so let's say that we're limited into $150,000. Obviously, if I was willing to pull out my financial calculator, we would see what would be the impact of that over 10 years at 5%. I'll say I'm going to miss this bad, and all of my financial friends are going to mock me. But let's say you end up with 250, right? So you're going to end up with 25% of what was earned in that period being retained. And then, if you think about this, you've got all of your other capital that's already invested, subjected to a particular interest rate, probably higher than 5%, if we're being honest. I would view that as good. I would actually view that as good, especially if some of those wages of that million were paying down a 15-year mortgage, where you're on a good house, where your net worth is increasing because of the appreciation of homes. And again, everyone's situation is going to be different. I think this is a fascinating conversation to have with a financial advisor and saying, am I making the best use of my future wages with the strategy we have in place?
Here's the thing that occurred to me a few minutes ago. So it's pot let's say that, you know, I'm in a field that pays just a lot more money than journalism. My lifetime earnings at this point have been $20 million,
Okay, I like this.
and I have saved 2 million. My net worth is 2 million. Now, that Mason, you know, looks at me, this Mason, and goes, "You're a pauper because you only have $600,000." But the Mason who already has $20 million has a lifestyle that has only allowed him to save 10%. And that lifestyle is going to kill him in retirement.
Yeah. This goes to one of the fundamental things we've talked about actually for years now on this podcast is, and this illustrates it. The goal in all of this is to not need a lot of money, right? So a lot of people are like, ah, oh, I want to have a lot of money, but they're wrong. It's like, no, how can you tell me wrong? No, I am telling you're wrong. That's not the goal. The goal is to not need a lot of money because, and your example of realistic Mason and then dream Mason, which is my nickname for you. You've got a person who doesn't need a lot of money and has a modest amount. And then the other situation, you've got someone that has a ton of money, but needs so much of it that you actually want situation A. And I would argue most Americans should head towards situation A.
Right. Now, people who are listening to this, they're going, "Oh, guys, this is really squishy. Just tell me how much I need to put away."
Well, it depends how old you are.
I know, but let's of the time that I have left,
I'd love you to approach 20%.
20%.
Yeah, so that's to say find another 5 grand a year in a perfect world, which we don't live in because of my male pattern baldness as proof. I think 35% going towards increasing your net worth on an annual basis is the true sign of financial health. Okay, so let me deal with this here for a second. That can mean, and we'll use your numbers, 15% going towards my 401k, 5% going towards a savings account. So I'm at 20% right now. Let's say I make a couple of IRA investments or whatever, I'm up to 30%. Even if that last 5% is representative of the principal of my mortgage that I'm paying off on an annual basis, I would, to get me to that 35%, that is the picture of health. If you can be above 35% of your gross wages going towards increasing your net worth, that's when you know you're doing it right. And I would also say that's the sign that you're on track to retirement.
And you're talking about 35% consistently over my lifetime, going for 35%.
Yeah, but again, it's this weird number. It is not just this is what you should peel off your paycheck. You also have to look. Again, the mortgage is an important part of this. Paying down that mortgage principal, getting rid of that expense, just like you said, the $800 a month that you don't have to worry about. And then also having that real estate investment be one that retains wealth as opposed to choosing words, how do I say this? Sometimes starter homes don't hold their value, as you learned in Chicago. And so that drives a larger gap between the financial haves and have-nots for that particular reason. But I would also say, let me tie this to a very technical financial point, is this is why underhousing yourself, this is why not spending as much as you could on a house is so vitally important. Because yes, your house might appreciate a particular level, and yes, you're purchasing your home over time from the bank via the mortgage. But if you can underhouse yourself and then invest that difference off to the side, you will beat your neighbor down the street in the nicer house who has the same wage every single time. And Midwesterners should be able to get their heads around this and understand that you live in a relatively inexpensive place. And what's really strange is when we do work with people, you know, out on the East Coast or, you know, in the West Coast, it's not even a consideration, because there's just this scrap for home ownership, just this, you're fighting to get in somewhere. And I think, again, if you're going to choose to live in the Four Seasons locale of Central Indiana, you've got to take in that in consideration to build wealth, because the wages aren't as high on the other coasts. And so your advantage is low housing costs.
Yeah, exactly. So just to make sure I understand, for when I am calculating my net worth, am I just looking at the equity that I have in my home, not how much the state tells me it's worth?
Yeah, great question. I know we all feel a little weird when we open those tax assessment forms that come to mail. Mine came this week, and I opened it. I was like, oh, because it's like, oh my gosh, this is the level I'm paying tax on. I would do based on the market value of your home, which is what you could sell for. So those comps in your neighborhood, if you can be honest with yourself, that's how I would calculate the equity in your home.
Okay. All right. Cause that's fine. Because that's like, for us, that's good. I mean, we bought, my wife bought the home before we got married at really kind of a bargain, and the neighborhood has done very well. So
what the takeaway from this episode is, you married a much younger partner who made better investment decisions than you, and now you're eating sardines at your desk. Those are my notes that I've taken during this episode.
Why shouldn't I just be happy all the time? And the answer is, I don't know. That's just who I am.
Yeah, I mean, with these facts here, this hypothetical single Mason would never exist. You're too much of a catch.
That's right. All right. Well, that's enough for me to get in trouble for at home. Well, I'll pencil you in for episode 400.
Well, great. Well, congrats on episode 300, and hello to your mother.
Oh, that is like the worst like rap sign off ever.
Well, no, I didn't say word to your mother.
I know.
It would be a rap sign.
It was worse.
Like, you said your mom likes me, so I said hello to your mother.
Yeah. Well, she's listening right now, so she'll take it. Okay. Thank you so much. I will talk to you later.
Thanks, Mason.
And my thanks again to Pete Dunn. A quick reminder, his column on personal finance appears regularly in the print edition of IBJ, and you can find several years worth of his work at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest print edition of IBJ I want to point out. First up, a pilot program that has sought to put Indianapolis renters on a more even playing field with their landlords in eviction cases faces an uncertain fate with the end of federal COVID-19 funding. Taylor Wooten examines the murky future of one of the few tools city officials have to address Indianapolis's high frequency of evictions. Also in this week's issue, John Russell asks officials at health system Ascension whether its latest round of restructuring will result in the sale or closure of operations in Central Indiana. And Mickey Shuey gauges the pressure facing the downtown office market. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.